Hi FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
You're on 101.9 Hi FM. I'm Kathy Kayla, standing in for Howard Feldman. Hopefully it's not too painful an experience for you, but he will be back, I promise, on your radio in January. Right now, speaking to Professor Barry Shoup. Good morning. How are you, Professor?
Very well, thank you. How are you doing?
Oh, it's so lovely to hear your voice. You've been busy, huh?
Yeah, trying to keep busy, trying to keep out of mischief.
Yeah, I'm sure that this year has been just a game changer. All right, so where are we in terms of coronavirus in South Africa?
Well, we're in the very midst of a very severe second wave. Really mainly seen, first of all, in the Eastern Cape, then the Western Cape and KwaZulu-Natal. Up here in Gauteng, we're still going to receive the brunt of it when all the holiday makers come back from their well-deserved rest. But at the moment, Gauteng is relatively, and I stress it was relatively, quieter. Not quiet, but quieter. Until probably in the next couple of weeks, when I think we're going to hit quite a storm.
Yeah, I'm seeing reports from hospitals and private and general saying that they're under a lot of pressure already.
Indeed. Oh, well, you know, I think throughout the country, both private and public hospitals are experiencing now equipment shortages, oxygen shortages, hospital and bed shortages. And of course, personnel are now starting to feel the stress, particularly down in the Cape, just at the Capes and KZN.
Yeah. Okay. This mutated virus, what do we know about it?
The variant?
The variant, well, yes.
Know, yeah, it's not really saying from a virological or biological point of view, which is really too surprising. You know, if you've got a minute or two, I'll just give the background.
Sure.
You know, these viruses do multiply rapidly and regularly. And when they multiply, they make copies of themselves. And sometimes when they make copies of themselves, they sometimes make a mistake or two or three or four. And when they make a mistake, they substitute one of the building blocks in their structure. We call the building blocks amino acids. They substitute that with another amino acid. And as a result, they might change their characteristics. Now, most cases of these mutations doesn't have any effect at all. But sometimes, and this is what has happened now with the variant, it can make the virus more contagious, more infectious. It's easier to transmit from person to person because that the actual docking site where the virus gets onto the receptor of the cells that it infects, it does it more vigorously, more strongly. The net result, the bottom line, is that these viruses are more, the variants are more contagious. They've actually calculated it's about 70% more contagious than the parental strain, than the original strain. And that's a concern because it does transmit more readily. And in fact, you know, where they've done the work it started off in Nelson Mandela Bay and then spread very rapidly through the country. And when they're looking at specimens, they can see that, in fact, this variant has now become the dominant strain in South Africa. It's actually displaced the parent strain, the original strain. And I think that's also happening in other countries like the United Kingdom and a number of countries in Europe and Australia. So it's a worldwide phenomenon, in fact. There's a term, it's called the 501 variant, because 501 is the position where the substitution has taken place. Okay. Hope I haven't been too technical, but
I think you've explained it extremely well. Ian Smith, one of our listeners, wants to know, can you please ask Barry about the use of ivermectin for the treatment of COVID?
Yeah, you know, there have been a lot of these kind of potential, what you call reuse of drugs.
Yeah.
You know, in the early days, they were struggling, you know, what can we use to treat the drugs, to treat the infection? So there was hydroxychloroquine, which is used for malaria. Ivermectin, which is used for treating worms, in fact. It's an anti-worm medicine. Now, all of these things, you know, if you in the laboratory, if you add them to a viral culture, they will kill the virus for sure. But, you know, if you add alcohol, if you add Jay's fluid, if you add all of these things, they'll kill the virus. But when they've examined it clinically in a well-controlled clinical trial, unfortunately, there's been no effect at all. So ivermectin is one of these. Unfortunately, it would be lovely if it would work, because it's cheap, it's readily available. But unfortunately, it doesn't work. It just simply doesn't work when you actually evaluate it in a clinical trial. That goes for hydroxychloroquine. It goes for quite a number of these things which have been tried. We'd love it to work, but it just doesn't.
Yeah. We had some messages earlier about quinine and vitamin D. What's your thought on that?
Yeah. Well, quinine is actually hydroxyquinine. It's the same thing, a quinine used for malaria. Again, if you do it in the test tube, it will kill the virus. But in clinical trials, when they really, really look at it and examine it, it's got no effect whatsoever. Quinine, of course, can be toxic. So you really don't think that should be used at all.
Yeah, and certainly not for pregnant women.
Vitamin D is one of these things, and other vitamins and zinc and so on, which are supposed to, I don't know, support the immune system. But again, when they look at it clinically in well-controlled clinical trials, doesn't seem to have much effect at all. It's not harmful, but it doesn't seem to be effective.
Talking about the immune system, we live in a country where many, many people have compromised immune systems, whether it's from HIV, whether it's from something else.
Yeah.
Do people with compromised immune systems fare better or worse with COVID-19?
No, generally speaking, they do fare worse. The actual course of the infection has got two stages. The first stage is due to the virus multiplying. It multiplies and it damages tissues like the lung tissue. Now there, if your immune system is suppressed, you don't have an immune system to attack the virus, to get rid of the virus, and therefore it'll be worse prognosis. The problem is that there's a second phase of the infection, which is due to the immune system. Mm. The immune system trying to get rid of the virus, but in doing so, it causes damage. And that's really the kind of the stage which is a serious stage. It's what we call a cytokine storm. You might have heard the term.
Sure.
And that causes acute respiratory distress. And that's the stage that we treat with steroids, because steroids do suppress the immune system. So theoretically, if your immune system is already suppressed, you should fare better for that second stage, which already you won't fare better from the first stage, which is actually the prime thing which causes the damage. So the bottom line is, if your immune system is compromised or is suppressed in some ways, you're not going to do too well.
Okay. Thanks, Professor. Clive has got a question. He says, please ask Professor Shub about UV being used. So I've also seen reports about these UV lights, that UV lights kill the virus. What's your thought on that?
They do, and they are used in theatres, for example. They're used in wards. It's really to kind of, decontaminate air.
Yes.
But it has to be UV, which is the right, you know, unfortunately, I'm not really an expert in this, but the right wavelength, the right intensity, and so on,
right,
to be able to do it. And, of course, in the hospitals, they do use it quite extensively. We don't really kind of advocate it for like factory use and shop use and so on. The same goes for fogging and all these kind of things. Really, because basically, in that situation, really what you want to do is a good thorough cleaning of surfaces. That's more than adequate. Don't really need it. But obviously in the hospital situation, that's a different story. And there it has been used. It is widely used.
Yeah.
And UV, of course, would kill the virus. Even sunlight does. They've done an experiment and they show that sunlight, ordinary sunlight, in fact, it was done in the Northern Hemisphere. So we've actually got more intense sunlight. But the Northern Hemisphere, they showed that exposure to sunlight will kill the virus in within 6 minutes.
But that also doesn't make sense, because, I mean, we're in summer. People are spending time outdoors, especially if they're seeing friends and family, you know, socially distanced and whatever. I understand that the sun rays have got, there is UV, there's UVA and UVB. But so how is it that our rates are still going up if everybody's spending time outdoors?
Kathy, the answer to that is two words: human behavior.
Yeah.
Human behavior.
Gosh, obviously, haven't we learned a lot about outdoors, human behavior, huh?
Outdoors are obviously vastly better than indoors, because outdoors disperses those infectious droplets.
Yeah.
Sunlight is good because it'll inactivate the virus. But it'll take 6 minutes to inactivate the virus. We won't do it instantaneously.
Okay.
Also, okay, outdoors does disperse droplets. But if you are very close to somebody and you're chatting away and you're socializing, even outdoors, and you're chatting away for 20 minutes, for half an hour and so on, then even if you're outdoors and even the sun's baking down, you can still transmit the virus. It's all relative.
Yeah.
Now, one's better than the other, but I mean, the physical distancing, the socializing, that's really what promotes it, even if it's the outdoors or not. And that's why we get asked about winter. Is it worse in winter? Nothing to do with the actual temperature. It's to do with the fact that in winter people are indoors, the windows are closed, the ventilation's poor, and that's what actually promotes this, the spread of the virus. That's what they're having in the Northern Hemisphere now, of course.
Yeah. Colin's got a question for you, Professor. Are the vaccines sure. being used in other parts of the world okay? Surely a vaccine takes a number of months or years to develop and get right. So this is really your area, isn't it?
That's an excellent question because a lot of people ask, a lot of people who are fearful of the vaccine are worried because it's taken so quick. Now, normally vaccines will take anything from 5 to 20 years in some of the vaccines which we use to develop. Now, it's gone through the various, you know, laboratory stages, then the phase 1, phase 2, phase 3 clinical trials, etc. That takes a long time, between 5 and 20 years. The coronavirus vaccine is taken less than a year. You know, the virus was only detected and isolated in January, February of this year. And already we've got a vaccine. It's what the Americans call warp speed.
Yeah.
But, you know, what I can reassure Corin and other listeners is that the safety protocols, the safety mechanism, the safety monitoring is so rigorous and so intense. And it goes all the way from the initial trials, the phase one trials to phase two to phase three. Then it goes through the licensing, goes to international licensing, goes to local licensing. And to make absolutely sure that the vaccines are safe, they have to be, because we're giving vaccines to healthy people. It's not like medicines. Medicines we give to sick people, so there you can weigh up, are the medicines much safer than the illness? Vaccines have to be superbly safe because we're giving it to people that don't have the illness yet. So there are rigorous control. And the vaccines which are being used now overseas, they have been licensed by WHO, been licensed by FDA, been licensed by the European Medicine Authority, by the British Medicine Authority, for the reason that they are shown to be safe as well as effective.
Okay, fair enough. Professor Shoup, Renee messaging from Israel, and she wants to know, she says, please ask the professor, if one has had COVID, is it still necessary to have a vaccine or vaccination?
Yeah,
I think that that's a great question.
That's a very great question. Look, the answer is that yes. The bottom line is yes. And the reason I'm saying yes is that we don't know how durable the immunity is after the infection. There have been a lot of studies, many, many studies. There have been some studies which have shown that people do get second infections. And they can prove it because they do a molecular study of the virus from the first infection and a molecular study of the virus from the second, and they show that they're different. So you can prove that some people, but it's not common, but also it's not easy to kind of do those tests. So we don't know how common it is. It's probably not that common. But we do kind of suspect that people do get second infections. On the other hand, when they do laboratory studies in people that have had the infection, they can demonstrate immunity going for even a couple of months afterwards. So the bottom line is we don't really know how effective and how long-lasting that immunity is. So it's probably much better to get the vaccine, irrespective of when you had it or not. Now, this is the information in December 2020.
It might change by January.
Evolving.
Yeah.
Yeah. Knowledge does evolve. There's a colleague who went on one of these interviews and he said he wished he could come back in 2 weeks' time so he can correct all the mistakes he made in that interview.
Well, it is a bizarre. I mean, it really is a bizarre virus. It defies everything. Yeah. I mean, it's completely
all in the
different.
Learning curve.
Yeah, 100%.
But the one thing I should mention, because I also get asked that, is there a problem in getting the vaccine if you've had the infection? And the answer is definitely no. It doesn't cause any problems. Even if you are immune and you get the vaccine, it doesn't cause any problems. So it's much better to be safe going on the fact that we're not quite sure how long the immunity lasts.
Yeah. And is it a vaccine that we're going to have every year, like a flu jab? Or is it you're now vaccinated and you're good to go?
Well, again, that's one of the unanswered questions. It's too early to know.
Yeah.
We're hoping it's going to last, give at least more than a year's, but it may not be. You know, for influenza, we have to have it every year. In fact, there's actually one vaccine manufacturer which is incorporating the coronavirus into the influenza virus, as one vaccine. It's a combined vaccine against flu and against coronavirus. So, on the assumption that you'd need it annually. But at this stage, we don't know.
Okay. A very interesting question, and this really speaks to how long the virus exists on surfaces, different surfaces. So Mark, right, messaging, he says, please ask Professor Barry, if someone who's been positive and driven a car but hasn't driven the car for 72 hours now, is it safe for somebody else to drive the car?
Yes, the virus won't really survive to any extent beyond 72 hours. Some even say 24 hours. It's always going to depend. I mean, if it is, so I don't want to get gross on radio. If there is material, mucus or saliva and so on, it might survive a bit longer because the protein in that will kind of protect the virus.
Yeah.
But generally speaking, if it's a reasonably clean surface, it's not going to survive for more, probably even more than 24 hours. If people wash their hands and sanitize their hands and try and avoid touching their face, because that's the way it will get, it'll get in. You know, viruses can't go through intact skin and viruses can't move. So the only way it'll get, if you contaminate your hands and then touch nose, mouth, and also eyes as well.
Yeah.
Those mucous membranes, that's the only way it can get in. So that kind of route of transmission, no people worry about that. They start decontaminating shoes and chairs and so on. That's really not necessary.
What if it's on your food?
You get the virus by inhaling it. Sorry.
Okay. What happens if somebody who, I don't know, say somebody who's cooking your food, either a restaurant or in your home, tests positive? Are there any risks for you if that food has been breathed on or anything like that?
No.
That's not a risk. Ingesting the virus isn't as much of a problem as coming into contact with your mucous membranes.
Correct. Ingesting the virus is not really a problem.
Okay.
You know, you have to if it's something cold and you touch it and then you touch your face, but people don't generally do that. So the bottom line on to your answer, no, food is not really a problem.
Okay.
And certainly once it gets into the stomach, it'll definitely won't be a problem.
Yeah. David, thank you so much for your message. He says, David wants to know, if we got a vaccine so quickly, is it theoretically possible to get a vaccine for the common cold now?
Well, that's unfortunately
a reasonable question.
The common cold is much more of a challenge. You know, it's not so much of a challenge to actually design a vaccine against coronavirus. And that should be a reasonably straightforward. It's a virus which we know the proteins which stimulate the immune system, what you call the antigens.
Yeah.
It's not too difficult to design a vaccine. The common cold, there are over 100 different strains. So it's a difficult one to actually design. Also, it's a very superficial infection. So it's the immune system doesn't even get a chance to kind of act against it.
Yeah.
So I don't think you're going to get a common cold vaccine for. And there's not really much impetus. It doesn't cause that severe. It's a bit inconvenient, and that's about it.
I was reading an article on one of the major news sites, and it was titled "Everything We Know About Coronavirus." It was an international site, and they noted few groups that already have predispositions, even if they don't have health issues. So, one, if you're a male, you're more likely to get coronavirus. If you are overweight or obese, you're more likely to get coronavirus. And then they mentioned if you're blood type A. Have you heard about this, Professor?
Yeah. It's not so much that you get the virus. Everybody's equally susceptible to being infected. It's when you, once you're infected, if you get a more severe disease. So as you say, male, being overweight, diabetic and so on, are what we call comorbidities. In other words, you're more likely to get more severe disease.
Yeah.
And blood group, they also have shown that certain blood groups like group A, it's sort of a marginal thing, are more likely to get more severe disease. But it's not to say that, that you're group A that you've got a comorbidity. It's not like diabetes or being overweight or being old age.
Yeah.
There is a slightly increased with some blood groups, slightly decreased with group O. But it's not that if you've got group A, you're not going to get severe disease. Not at all. These are very subtle differences.
Yeah. Professor Shub, before I let you go, we've reached over a million cases of coronavirus in South Africa about 11 o'clock last night. Do you think that a second lockdown would be justified?
Kathy, if it was purely on public health criteria, yes. Because what it would do, it would slow down the infection. It would move the peak. I think the one thing that we do need to recognize, it won't stop the epidemic. It'll delay the peak. But in delaying the peak, it also kind of flattens it a bit.
Yeah.
So purely public health-wise, it's not that it's going to knock out the epidemic. Not at all. It delays that peak and it might reduce it. But the cost, you always have to look at what the cost of an intervention is compared to what it's supposed to achieve. And the cost in this case is just prohibitive. There's no way we can go down to a hard lockdown. I think they may increase, and I think they probably will increase some restrictions. They may increase the level up to level 2, maybe even level 3, but certainly not to a hard lockdown. We just can't, the actual cost. And it's also not the cost to prevent, not only the cost economically, it's the cost of preventing other infections, other diseases other than COVID, because they've also suffered because of COVID.
Yeah.
So, I think that's not going to, I don't think a hard lockdown's going to happen, but in the increasing restrictions they may well introduce. I think they will, and I hope they will.
What do you mean by that, that other diseases have also suffered because of COVID?
Well, because a lot of the kind of, there are two things. One of them, people don't go for their routine maintenance. People that are
trying to stay away from, yes.
Yeah, the diabetics, antenatal care, HIV maintenance, TB maintenance, and also a lot of the healthcare facilities are diverted to COVID at the expense. So, for example, cold surgery has been postponed in many cases. There aren't enough beds in the hospitals to look at the other diseases. So that's why they kind of suffer. And it's been shown statistically.
Professor Shub, once again, it is an absolute pleasure to speak to you. You are so knowledgeable. Thank you so much for making the time to speak to us all this morning and for answering so many listener questions. Really appreciate it. And I wish you a safe and healthy 2021. And I'm sure that it won't be the last time that we speak.
Yeah, thanks, Kathy. And you too, all the best to you and the listener.
Thank you so much. God bless. Bye-bye. That's Professor Barry Shub. Isn't he just fantastic? So incredibly knowledgeable. What a pleasure to speak to the man.
Chai FM, your station of choice since 2008.